The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
Without freedom of the press, no democratic form of government could exist.
Good night, and good luck.
Good evening from our CBS newsroom in New York.
NBC presents Chet Huntley and David Brinkley.
From ABC, this is World News Tonight, with Peter Jennings in London, Max Robinson in Chicago.
When the press is free, the people of a country are free. When the press is not free, the people of a country are in danger of slavery.
Keeping you informed with information, news, and the views of people making the news. It's the Nicole Sandler Show on NicoleSandler.com and the Progressive Voices Network.
That was the Battle of Gettysburg. What an unbelievable, I mean, it was so much, it's so interesting and so vicious.
I know the former guy is facing lots of different trials, though it's hard to keep track. And we've seen his routine of telling lies and getting mean while he goes on the attack. But lately he's been way more incoherent, and it's fair to say he just may crack. Because every day it seems that Trump is saying something stupid like,
tough hurricane, one of the wettest we've ever seen from the standpoint of water.
He can barely keep his eyes open, but he keeps spewing lies we've heard a bunch before. His babbling keeps on streaming, but to me he's never seemed so out to lunch
F-35s,
before.
Fighter jets, they're stealth, you can't see them.
Although his rants aren't valid, he's convinced that his word salad is delighting his base.
They gaze upon the Semites, Semites.
But nothing's gonna budge if he keeps pissing off the judge or makes that scowling face.
I don't mind being Nelson Mandela.
If I were his attorney, I would urge the guy to learn that doesn't help his case. But he throws advice away. He's always saying something stupid like,
to take out clean coal, meaning to take it out coal. They're going to clean it.
His grasp of basic facts has always been completely whacked and usually makes us snort.
Robert E. Lee, who's no longer in favor. Did you ever notice
that? He sounds just like a kid who makes up crap because he didn't do his book report.
Gettysburg, wow.
And yet the GOP apparently believes that he should be their favorite one.
I've done more for the black community than any other president since Abraham Lincoln.
He's a real threat to our democracy, and yet we can't forget to make fun.
Maybe including Abraham Lincoln, frankly.
So it's okay to laugh at every gaffe because we know there's gonna be a ton.
Never fight uphill, me boys. Never fight uphill.
His mind is clearly straying, always saying something stupid like,
it was reported that an illegal ad delivered him, and you just look at this, what's happening.
New songs I'll be creating when he's stating something stupid like,
legal person, woman, man, camera, TV.
Something stupid like this.
They say, that's amazing. How did you do that?
Or something stupid like this.
I mean, it was so much and so interesting and so vicious and horrible
like
and
this.
So beautiful in so many different ways. It represented
like
such a big portion of
the. Before you got the video, it's Lauren with a quick request. If these videos are helping you cope with the news by laughing at it, I hope you consider helping me keep them going by subscribing to my Patreon. For as little as $2 a month, you get extra content and bonus goodies, as well as the satisfaction of knowing you're supporting the arts. Well, at least this artist. Thanks.
Thanks. Lauren Mayer, everybody, getting us started with, you know, I have used that. I have used something stupid in video, you know, in audio montages dealing with former presidents. Actually, I used to do it when it came to, whatchamacallit, did I lose Lisa? I thought she was there. George W. Bush. In fact, when he left, you know, up until Donald Trump, W was the man. W was the guy who prompted a bumper sticker somewhere, a village is missing its idiot. You know, George W. Bush was a moron, but now we have Donald Trump, go figure. But Lauren Mayer did a great job on that video, as she does on hers. I like to get the show started with a bit of the humor because, you know, so much is not funny these days. you know. But we've got a busy show for you today because so much has been going on. And as always, I'm thrilled to welcome our guest, who today, once again, is Lisa Graves. Lisa, you there?
Can you hear me?
I hear you now. I got to figure out. And now the chat room has to tell us if you're echoing. But okay, I hear you. And you sound so much better than you did on the phone. So yeah, this is the way to go.
Yes. So sorry to intrude on the beginning of your program, which is wonderful. And sorry for this little technical glitch.
No worries. I'm just so glad you're here. Okay. So no echo. I just have to check with the chat room because with all the, you know, we go out, I send out a video stream to YouTube, to Shitter, to Twitch, to Facebook, and I send the audio stream out to the Progressive Voices Network and the other audio-only channels that carry us, and to my stream, and to TuneIn. So with all these different channels, what I'm monitoring is always clean, but then we get an echo on YouTube, and everyone's saying, sounds good, no echo. Yay. So, yay. So Lisa Graves, I say yay for a number of reasons today. And of course, that Lisa Graves is here. Today on the show notes, I took your bio from the TrueNorthResearch.org site because I don't go through your tons of experience every time you're on the show because it would take half the show. But you've got the legal bona fides, everything from serving as Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Office of Policy Development and Legal Policy at the Department of Justice under Attorneys General Janet Reno and John Ashcroft, Chief Counsel for Nominations for Senator Patrick Leahy on the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee, Deputy Chief of the Article 3 Judges Division of the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts with oversight of the Financial Disclosure Office and more. See, it goes on like that. So I put it all down there so people can read. But I wanted to make sure that everyone knows, you know, that you've got the chops to back up everything you say here, which you do on this program as a private citizen, because your day job is as founder and executive director of True North Research. And today you guys dropped a new report.
We did. You are so observant. I really appreciate that, Nicole. We on True North site, we put a new report out detailing how some of these billionaires and people with access to $1 billion have been targeting our state Supreme Court. So while most of the attention this week is on the U.S. Supreme Court and the arguments that it's hearing, we know that that's not the only way in which these billionaires have tried to rewrite the rules and rig the rules of the game to advance their super narrow and regressive agenda. And so that report details how Leonard Leo has targeted the state levers of power, including state Supreme Courts, but he's also done that for more than two decades in trying to change the rules in state after state to limit merit selection, to limit judges being chosen based on merit versus based on whether they pass his personal test, in essence, or the test of his, you know, right-wing funders. So, that report is up on TrueNorthResearch.org, and it's our state court report. It also talks about Dick Uihlein and Jeff Yass and David Koch and others.
You know, somebody the other day mentioned something to me in the chat about I need to, you know, because I'm a one-woman show here. You need to get something from Uihlein. No, I don't. Somehow I got on their mailing list. But the company, the office supply company, Uihlein, is owned by this Uihlein family. It's spelled slightly differently, but it's them. And they're horrible. It's a name that is not a household name, but it should be. Don't buy office supplies from them. And she got Leonard Leo, Dick Uihlein, Charles Koch, and Jeff Yass, who's also the person whose name has come into the conversation lately because he's the primary, I guess, shareholder in TikTok. And he's a guy who put up a lot of the money for Trump, right?
Jeff Yass, he was already a very rich guy because his business are these super rapid trades, in the stock exchange, basically. So he was already super rich, but early on, he invested in ByteDance, which ultimately became most known for TikTok, right, which then took off. And so he is a substantial holder of ownership in TikTok. And one of the peculiar things you could say that happened in the past month is that after a visit between Donald Trump and Jeff Yass, suddenly Donald Trump was no longer supporting the congressional measures to assail TikTok for its ties to the Chinese government and, you know, what that could mean in terms of, you know, potential surveillance or data, you know, data capture, that sort of thing. So, you know, on the sort of pay to play in the sort of pay to play universe, you despite Donald Trump's many statements about China, suddenly after meeting with a billionaire who's very active in U.S. politics, who along with Dick Uihlein is one of the biggest funders of this thing called Club for Growth, which is super active in these elections. Suddenly, Donald Trump was no longer on board with the congressional Republican and actually a bipartisan effort to put some rules on TikTok.
Right. So there are names that we in some cases know, like Charles Koch, thanks to you and your work, really, Lisa Graves. But also, you know, the newcomers are the ones just coming into our orbit. They're not necessarily newcomers, but they've kept their name out of it until recently. But they're there now. Go ahead. Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say on Uihlein. So yeah, Uihlein is an old dude, like Charles Koch, but he's only, you know, in the most recent, you know, several years become much more active in, you know, in these political fights. He, you know, I think he's been that way for quite a while, but he was one of the, he helped underwrite some of the groups that helped plan the January 6th events that were the prelude to the insurrection. And he also assailed, you know, efforts to try to mitigate COVID, you know, it, just an array of things that he's been behind over the years. But part of what happened is that, you know, from the sort of nest egg that he got from his father, who was an heir to a beer fortune, you know, his dad staked him and his wife, Elizabeth, in their business, which you said, you know, which you noted was Uihlein, U-L-I-N-E,
right,
to sell these boxes and office supplies. But during the pandemic, when so many people were getting so many more things on boxes, Uline's wealth seemingly went, you know, sort of through the roof. And in that same period, that's when Uihlein began targeting state Supreme Courts with these new, this new nest of organizations, along with, you know, other big groups like spending millions to back the Susan B. Anthony list. And I just can't resist this one note to underscore, which is that last year in 2023, when we were looking at who was spending big in the Wisconsin Supreme Court case or Supreme Court race, pardon me, that was the election where one of the issues was whether Wisconsin Supreme Court was going to uphold a ban on abortion dating back to before the Civil War, basically right when Wisconsin became a state, or not. And what happened was Dick Uihlein was basically bankrolling the election of an anti-choice, anti-abortion, anti-gay candidate. And when we looked into it, it turned out that Dick Uihlein was the biggest known funder of one of the groups running ads in that campaign. Bear with me because the punchline is worth it. It turned out that Susan B. Anthony List's group called Women Speak Out, its biggest funder was Dick Uihlein.
God, these people are just despicable. But so let me ask you this, because there's news, speaking of a state Supreme Court here where I'm living now in Arizona, this moronic Supreme Court put an 1864 law back into effect that effectively bans all abortions in the state of Florida. The Arizona House of Representatives, of course, dominated by Republicans, twice refused, you know, shut down a vote to overturn it. Today, they finally did. The Arizona House repealed the 1864 abortion law. Now it goes to the Senate, where your guess is as good as mine, but it could be headed to the governor's desk. Katie Hobbs, of course, would sign it, but it's got to get through the Senate first. And I would think with all the backlash lately, hopefully they read the writing on the wall. But I know that in the meantime, the Arizona Democratic Party has organized a thing to challenge the Republican Arizona Supreme Court justices who are up for re-election this year. So there's a new initiative to get them out of there.
It's just extraordinary. I'm really interested to hear about that House action in the state. I've been consumed with some of the other news that we're probably going to talk about, but I didn't realize that had happened. But, you know, one of the things that was just astonishing, it was certainly on my mind, you know, last year in thinking about the Wisconsin law and thinking about that Arizona decision by the Arizona Supreme Court, which has been packed by Republican governors.
Yes.
That and expanded by Republican governors in order to kind of maintain their majority, even against the demographic tide in Arizona. It's just stunning to me to think that judges would have no problem basically allowing a law restricting abortion to go into effect, a law that predated women even having the right to vote in America.
Before Arizona was even a state.
Before Arizona was a state, before women could have credit cards. It is an archaic law and one in which women had no consent, no role in having any say over that law. And it's also the case, as you point out, that Arizona has retention elections this year. That's different than a contested election. It's in U.S. history been very difficult to not retain a judge, to not reach the threshold for a retention. But I, you know, hear that there may be some effort to try to not retain some of those judges who ruled that way in that case. There, I think, are two judges who are up. But it's also the case that this is not just isolated in Arizona, this sort of retrograde, regressive approach. We've seen this in other states, like with Alabama, that ruling like about a month ago, yep. where the Alabama Supreme Court, you know, ruled that that somehow a frozen embryo was a minor child right. entitled to the same rights as someone born in the United States. And some of that opinion was infused with, you know, basically religious doctrine posing as law. And then, as you pointed out, there was a decision by the Florida Supreme Court, again, about access to abortion imposing a very regressive a vision of human freedom in terms of this this effort to bar abortion in Florida. And these decisions by these regressive courts, in that Florida court is one that was packed by Ron DeSantis specifically at the advice of Leonard Leo, the same guy who packed the U.S. Supreme Court. He was an advisor, an informal advisor to DeSantis in this effort to capture the Florida Supreme Court. And the people are reacting to this. The American people, you know, understand, I think a strong majority understand that freedom, if it means anything, certainly means the ability to control your own body, your own healthcare decisions, your destiny, and to not have the state impose, you know, someone else's religious views about your body, about pregnancy or what have you. And so that reaction in Florida has, you know, changed the landscape there in terms of a potential proposition. The reaction in Alabama, you know, provoked, you know, tremendous concerns in part because the effect on what that means for people who were undergoing IVF procedures is just extraordinarily disruptive and potentially damaging. Arizona's position, even though the attorney general said that she won't enforce that ancient law, the fact is that a future administration
would,
if it fell into the hands of a right wing theocrat, could.
That's right. Yeah.
So the Arizona Democratic Party is now organizing an initiative to unseat or to not retain the Supreme Court justices. I'm going to have to look into that group and maybe get some of those people on here. But even beyond that, in both Arizona and Florida, there will be questions, I believe, constitutional amendments in both states codifying a woman's right to abortion, to health care, to make her own decisions. Could conceivably flip Florida and Arizona blue.
Well, yeah, and that's not the only state where this is an issue. In Montana, where the right wing has attempted to capture that Supreme Court, despite the fact that Montana has a right to privacy in its state constitution, and state judges, following longstanding precedents, have, you know, stood by the precedent allowing people to have access to abortion. The state AG there in Montana was trying to prevent the state from even getting that a measure to protect the access to abortion on the ballot this year, because they're afraid. They're afraid that if people come out to vote for that, that these regressive, you know, politicians who want to restrict these rights will lose. We saw, you know, what happened in Ohio last year, where there was tremendous organizing by, millions of Ohioans to defend their right, not only to access abortion, but also their right to have propositions to, you know, not have this super high threshold that would limit their ability to put a proposition on the ballot. then, you know, we also saw right after that Dobbs decision in Kansas, again, sort of ruby red Kansas, where, you know, an effort by these, you know, zealots trying to ban abortion was, you know, and attacking that state Supreme Court as well, was pushed back and defeated by the people. And
that's so,
you know, I think when you look at what's happening nationally and state by state, you know, most people get what's happening. They don't want this out of control U.S. Supreme Court and these out of control other levers of power being used against their fundamental freedoms. And they are joining together to, you know, vote against.
Yes.
Vote against those who are trying to restrict access to abortion.
Right. And that's why I say, you know, look, my two states that I'm most closely aligned with these days, Florida and Arizona, could both. And look, Arizona was already heading blue. We've got two Democratic senators and a Democratic governor. You got a lot of crazies here, but it's been going in the right direction, where Florida has just been, you know, going downhill steadily for the last 20 years. But yeah, so this is encouraging, I think, that people will come out in droves in order to vote down these repressive, you know, archaic laws about women's bodies. But Lisa Graves, that brings us to today. And one of the many issues that I want to talk to you about, the Supreme Court. Now, we're gearing up for tomorrow, when the Supreme Court, or the extreme court, as I call them, is going to hear Donald Trump's ridiculous claim that he has something that he calls absolute immunity that does not exist. But hold that thought for a second, because this morning, the extremes heard arguments about emergency room care, whether a federal law that requires hospitals to provide emergency care applies to abortions in life-threatening situations, even in states with strict abortion bans. And I'm going to play. So did you listen to any of the arguments this morning?
I did. I listened to them, and then I read some of the recaps, because I had a couple calls that came in the middle of it. But I went back and read through the whole set of the argument. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm going to play one clip in which it seemed that Amy Coney Barrett is sort of had Sonia Sotomayor's back a little bit. They were like, momentarily anyway, it seemed to be on the same page.
Imagine a patient who goes to the ER with preprom, 14 weeks. Again, abortion is accepted. She's up, she was in and out of the hospital up to 27 weeks. This particular patient, they had to deliver her baby. The baby died. She had a hysterectomy. And she can no longer have children. All right, you're telling me the doctor there couldn't have done the abortion earlier?
Again, it goes back to whether a doctor can, in good faith medical judgment.
That's a lot for the doctor to risk.
Well, I think it's protective of doctor judgment, Your
Honor. When Idaho law changed to make the issue whether she's going to die or not, or whether she's going to have a serious medical condition, there's a big daylight by your standards, correct?
It is very case by case. The example
that's from the problem.
I'm kind of shocked, actually, because I thought your own expert had said below that these kinds of cases were covered. And you're now saying they're not?
No, I'm not saying that. That's just my point, Your Honor, is that.
Well, you're hedging. I mean, Justice Sotomayor is asking you, would this be covered or not? And it was my understanding that the legislature's witnesses said that these would be covered.
Yeah, and those doctors said if they were exercising their medical judgment, they could, in good faith, determine that life-saving care was necessary. And that's my point, is this a subjective
standard? But some doctors couldn't. Some doctors might reach a contrary conclusion, I think, is what Justice Sotomayor is asking you.
So that's just one clip where Amy Coney Barrett almost sounded reasonable. But the men on the court, Lisa Graves, all sounded like, we know better what women should be allowed to do with their bodies. Did I get it wrong?
No, I mean, the hubris, the arrogance of these Republican appointees to the U.S. Supreme Court, the men who are a majority on that court, was just extraordinary. You know, this idea that women who come to the emergency room, because they may be having a miscarriage, it may not be complete, they may be having an ectopic pregnancy, they may be having other complications, due to other medical conditions, and the idea that the doctor can only give them an abortion if they're at the brink of death is just horrifying, and quite frankly, it's inhumane. to basically make them wait. And as the question that Judge Sotomayor described, you know, shows this idea that they couldn't do it earlier. They couldn't do an abortion knowing that the person, you know, that the woman may have complications, may face serious risk of death, but they couldn't do it earlier. And I think that when you look at what that Idaho law says, I read it again before our call, you know, it basically says the doctor has a duty not just to the person who arrives at the emergency room, but they have basically an equal duty to the embryo or the fetus. So it basically puts this competition between the you know, the fetus and the woman who's in that operating room begging for treatment,
right,
for her health, for her life. And in the case that Judge Sotomayor described, with the consequence that not only, you know, could she lose her life, but she could lose her ability to have children in the future. And in that instance, you know, in many of these instances where women are facing complications, or people are facing complications, they desperately want children. They want a family, but they cannot continue this pregnancy. That's you know, aside from the reality that women should have a right to decide whether to, you know, go forward with a pregnancy or not, regardless of whether they have a, you know, health condition. But in this particular instance, in this Idaho scenario, which is real, you have doctors who would be risking criminal charges, risk losing their licenses if they proceed. And some anti-abortion zealot says you should have waited. You could have waited. If you'd waited, the problem would pass or something, and the pregnancy could go forward. But at that moment in that emergency room, you know, a person is there trying to save their life,
right,
trying to save their health.
Right.
And the fundamental arrogance, not just of these Republican judges like Alito and Thomas and Gorsuch, but also of these state legislators and these state AGs, predominantly men, who think that they should be making decisions in place of doctors exercising their best standard of care to protect the health and life of the mother of the patient before them. And I just think that, you know, to live in the year 2024 in America, unlike in almost any other country in the world, and have these arrogant, narrow-minded men intervening in your, you know, right to access healthcare.
Yep.
And this law, this EMTALA law, is fundamentally about health, your health, that you shouldn't have to wait to get treatment or surgery until you're about to die.
Right.
Which means you could very well die.
Yep.
Like, it basically risks your life in order to make an arbitrary policy decision that, in the view of these predominantly men, that they dislike abortion and they don't think women should have access to abortion. And so they're going to interpose their religious judgment basically as law against you to be able to just seek healthcare you need when you're in desperate circumstances, potentially desperate pain, bleeding. And if you're not about to die, then a doctor might say, I'm not willing to risk my license.
Right. It's astounding. All of it is astounding. And the fact that it's 2024 and we're having these arguments again is just, I can't find the word for it. Astounding doesn't go far enough. It's evil. Somebody said it's not hubris. It's evil. It's just evil.
I have to say, like, I, you know, I've thought about this a lot because I, you know, I definitely believe that someone for themselves can make a decision about whether they're willing to risk their life,
yes,
to continue a pregnancy that may risk their ability to walk this earth and have children in the future.
Yes.
That's an individual personal decision that someone could make based on their own moral compass, their own religious doctrine. You know, they're the teachers of their teachers and their faith. But the fact is that for most people, this is a personal choice. Most Catholics actually support access to abortion. There's a strong tradition in the Muslim and Jewish faith of allowing women to make that choice.
That's
about
right.
Abortion.
Yep.
early in their pregnancies, that it's their choice fundamentally.
Always.
You know, the reality is that, if, if someone wants to make that choice, that should be their choice. And it's not just like a choice that makes it sound like too light, because in fact, you know, people who have abortions, people who seek abortions have thought probably a lot more about it than the men who are passing these laws about the effect on their life. And yes. In fact, most people who have abortions already have children and are making a decision about the well-being of the children that they already have. They're assessing their relationship, like how strong is that relationship? Can they handle another pregnancy, within that marriage or that household? Can their body tolerate another pregnancy? These are core,
yes,
core intimate decisions for one's own self, one's own conscience, one's own destiny. And to me, almost nothing is a greater signifier of freedom than the freedom to control your body, to control your destiny, to determine whether you're going to have a child or have more children. That is nobody's business but yours, not the business of these legislators and not the business of these overreaching Supreme Court justices who have like an abstract theoretical view, I think, of women's bodies, of pregnancy, and who have no... sort of no reservation in a way about imposing their views as law. And so to the comment in the chat, I guess, about whether it's evil.
Yeah.
I do think it's evil to force someone to continue a pregnancy against their will.
Yes.
In Idaho, they have a provision that in theory allows an exception for rape, but the rape has to be reported to the police.
Right.
Or the guardians of a child have to report the incest, when incest is typically an in-family rape, basically.
That's right.
Sexual contact without consent with a minor, and or with consent with a minor, but without the minor being able to actually give real
consent.
Legally binding consent.
Right.
And so even their rape and incest exception is restrictive and would mean that people who later, you know, maybe they're in denial, they realize they're pregnant from a date rape or a uncle or father, you know, later realize they're pregnant, you know, contend with this horror and try to seek an abortion. If they've not reported that to the police, they can't get one.
Yeah, no, it's ridiculous. And plus, we're still waiting for the court's decision on the Mifepristone case, in which a judge in Texas, I believe, who has no medical training, no scientific background, he decided that an FDA approval that was given 20 years ago is no good. So he single-handedly got this drug pulled from the shelves, and now the Supreme Court, we're waiting for them to decide. Let me also say, none of them have a medical background or scientific training either. I'd rather defer to the FDA and to the doctors as to what's safe.
Well, that's right. So that in that case that was decided by Matthew Kaczmarek, who was appointed to the district court in Texas by Donald Trump as part of a series of judicial nominees that Leonard Leo, you know, basically blessed across the board in terms of these appointments. You have someone who is vehemently anti-choice, anti-abortion, a judge who literally lied to the Judiciary Committee of the American People by removing his name from an article, an anti-abortion article, right before he was confirmed to the bench. And someone who, basically asserted in an arrogant way that he could just strike down the accessibility of a drug that, you know, millions of Americans rely upon. Most abortions now are chemical or medicine abortions,
right?
That he could just second guess a ruling by the FDA, an agency that he's never worked for. He has no medical training to supersede or second guess that ruling. And he did so in a case that was obviously concocted to land at his doorstep by a group that was suddenly created in the town of Amarillo, Texas, to challenge the FDA's approval 20 years ago of Mifepristone. Now, that decision was upheld by this really horrific circuit court in the Fifth Circuit that included James Ho, another anti-choice, anti-abortion activist zealot who never should have been confirmed to the bench. Oh. But that bar, you know, is stayed on appeal pending the Supreme Court decision. So people still have access to these drugs in the meantime. But there's no certainty that this court will allow that access to continue, because this Supreme Court, in my view, is out of control. It is unconstrained by past precedents. It has unleashed this series of disasters on America through its rulings. And at the same time that it is considering whether a single judge can overturn, you know, 20 years of access to a medicine, to a particular medicine, which could create a precedent for overturning all manner of medicines based on, you know, getting to the right judge. The fact is that this court is also, this Supreme Court is also considering doing away with a thing called the Chevron precedent, Chevron doctrine, which requires federal judges to defer to agency expertise. And so across the board, whether judges can basically supplant the expert review of agency staff who, you know, may have years of work, you know, assessing pharmaceutical claims or assessing claims about benzene, you know, pollutants that Coke Industries, for example, has injected into or released into our environment from its plants. You know, a whole host of measures are at risk because this court, handpicked by Leo, put in place by Trump, is basically trying to roll back a century of legal precedents in order to advance this very regressive, repressive view of the law. And so, and it, and the last thing I'll say is, people may have heard that about a month or so ago, the Judicial Conference, which John Roberts is the head of, basically issued guidance that individual judges that have only one, or courts that only have one judge in a district, so like Kasmerick, can't just issue these sort of nationwide injunctions because it looks like and actually is judge shopping.
Yeah.
It means that, you know, they have gone to that court, created a case to go to that court in order to get the ruling that is precast. And so the Judicial Conference suggested that that not be allowed, that that the cases be assigned randomly, even if someone tries to get before a single judge house. And in response, the Texas judges have refused to follow that guidance.
Of course they have. You know, and now I just read something today that the governor of Texas has signed something. I believe he signed it. I've got it here somewhere. That a law making it illegal, I'm scrolling through because I know I wrote this down somewhere, making it illegal for anybody to use the Texas highway system to leave the state to go somewhere else to get an abortion.
I mean, you know, the thing that astounds me, like, first of all, it's outrageous. But second of all, you know, if these guys claim that they are aficionados of the Constitution, that they're originalists, that they follow the plain language of the Constitution.
Bullshit.
In the original Constitution, before the adoption of the Bill of Rights, which was a condition of ratification of the Constitution only had three actual rights delineated for people, which is why the people, you know, the revolutionaries that were, you know, survived the American Revolution, you know, demanded that there be other provisions like, you know, the First Amendment, et cetera. But in the original Constitution, there are only three express rights for people, aside from the way the Constitution describes, you know, what each branch does. And one of those rights is literally and expressly the right to travel.
Huh. Yeah. It, you know, it, we're in a very weird place in history. So let's put that on hold. The other weirdness in this place in history is the first time ever in this nation's 200 and some odd years of existence, a former president is in court on a criminal indictment, being charged with a crime. Now, you know, the media, we could do a whole show on the media, but they've been complicit in minimizing the importance of this case. And I heard one thing, I want to play this because it was the best answer that I've heard. It was this morning on Morning Joe, and Barb McQuaid, who I really like, Mika Brzezinski, asked her, what is the crime here? What is the actual crime for which Donald Trump is on trial?
What is the law that prosecutors are trying to prove that Trump broke? Or what is the crime that Trump committed that he's sitting there in court for? And how does Pecker's testimony help corroborate that in any way?
Well, of course, the law here is falsification of business records to conceal the commission of another crime. And I think what the prosecutors have done this, that is very helpful here is to start with the crime and then talk about the falsification of the business records as the cover-up, because that's really what it was, and that's why it matters. So here, the crime is a statute under New York law, 17-152, that makes it a crime to conspire to promote or prevent the election of any candidate candidate to office by unlawful means. And the unlawful means here is campaign expenditures without an intent to report them. And so Michael Cohen paid $130,000. The National Enquirer paid $30,000 to the doorman and $120,000 to Karen McDougal. It's those payments that make this illegal. So the moment that money changes hands, the crime is committed. And in fact, it's enough that they falsified these with the intent to do that. But they've also got that evidence of illegal campaign expenditures, and that plan, that conspiracy to violate that statute 17-152 occurred on that day in August of 2015. And it extended all the way through the election and beyond throughout this cover up.
And when you hear the specifics or read, we're still waiting on yesterday's transcript. The transcripts from Monday are now up on the New York court website. So they said they'll be available the following business by the end of the day, the following business day. So hopefully we'll see yesterday's transcript at some point this afternoon. But just the coverage of what David Pecker said, Lisa Graves, is pretty damning. I mean, it proved that what Donald Trump does when he calls out fake news is pure projection. It's exactly what he's been doing all along with David Pecker that he's accusing the rest of the media of doing.
Well, that's right. I mean, and let me just say again, in my personal capacity to share my personal views Please. With you about these a candidate like Trump, you know, the situation is it's unprecedented because we've never had someone who has engaged in this array of crimes, who has, you know, run for president or been a, you know, a leading party candidate. You know, so it's not unprecedented in the sense of like the way Trump has described it in his texts to me and, you know, millions of others about it's supposedly a witch hunt.
Right.
And he didn't do anything wrong. The reality is that there's ample evidence of wrongdoing here. That's why the case was charged. There's ample evidence already presented in the trial so far that shows, you know, what he did and why he did it and why it violates why it violates the law. And it's also the case that the story so far that's been reported, and Barbara McRae did such a fantastic job of describing it, I think. But the part of the story that really struck me was, you know, you have these tabloids that are, you know, right there as you check out of the supermarket. So, you know, basically anyone who uses a supermarket is getting hit with these, you know, the cover of the National Enquirer, which, according to Pecker and this testimony, was basically being used to, you know, pump up Trump and attack his opponents, both his Democratic opponents and his Republican opponents in the primary. And it was also used for this catch and kill component, which was to kill stories that would hurt Donald Trump. And the other part of that catch and kill component that wasn't David Pecker, the head of the National Enquirer, was the part where, you know, Michael Cohen was deployed to basically pay off Stormy Daniels so that this story would not be credited in that very close election. That was, in fact, an actually very close election in 2016. And there were other revelations that had come out, including, you know, the tape, you know, the tape that Trump, where Trump was caught on tape, you know, basically talking about his attempt to violate one of the Ten Commandments in terms of adultery and coveting. I think we talked about that.
The Access Hollywood tape.
Day, right. Coveting, lying and you know, adultery. But you also had, you know, the situation where had people learned that Donald Trump was in essence cheating on his third wife, who
his,
you know,
pregnant,
had been pregnant
third wife, right?
You know, like I think many people, regardless of their party, you know, reserve a special place in kind of theoretical hell for people who would dare to cheat on their pregnant wife.
Yes.
But in this case, cheating on his pregnant wife with this woman who, you know, in some ways bears a striking resemblance to his daughter, his other daughter, is also sort of unseemly.
Yes.
In sort of the other kind of visual aspects of this affair or this, you know, arrangement to pay her. But it's also the case that, you know, no one knows, given, you know, some Trump people would not have cared regardless of if this had come out, but some people might have. They might have cared that Trump had engaged in this behavior while his wife was pregnant. They might have cared that he, you know, if they learned even then that he had paid off a porn star, someone who had engaged in, you know, pornographic films in order to deceive the American people about like his status in essence. And so it really is a series of despicable acts, I would say, in my personal view, and something that is, this is not to say that I'm naive about the history of presidents having affairs or something, you know, that's, you know, unfortunately been a long part of U.S. history with different presidents. Well, but this is a case where, you know, you have someone who's running and who is, you know, creating this sort of scam and the paperwork scam to cover it up in order to keep this secret from the American people.
Yeah. The whole thing is astounding. And we knew about the catch and kill stories, but to hear David, well, we didn't hear it, but to get from David Pecker.
We knew before now, we didn't know at that moment.
Right. Yeah. But still, we didn't know the extent to which, like, Donald Trump is the one who devised the catch and kill idea about paying them for the story and then killing it so it never sees the light of day. That apparently was Trump. And when Pecker was asked, had you ever done this before, this meeting with Donald Trump where he brought, no, we hadn't. It had never been done before. And then the fact that all the stories they planted, Ted Cruz and his five, you know, mistresses. Well, I know it's inconceivable that five women would want to sleep with Ted Cruz, but the fact is, they made it up. The whole thing about his father being complicit in JFK's assassination, all the stories about Hillary Clinton, the massive headlines of she's crooked, she's, you know, she's horrible. All of that was David Pecker using his media outlet to perpetrate Donald Trump's lies to help get him elected.
Yeah, I mean, It's interesting to me. I mean, I'm trying to, like, how to process all this, because, you know, it's not that I believe that the National Enquirer always told the truth.
No,
like that, I was not ever that naive. But you know, so I always believe in seeing those headlines at the grocery store that, like, that's not true. But, like, you're bombarded with these lies. And as you said, this is a case where the business model really for the National Enquirer is to expose any, you know, hint of a scandal, no matter who it is. And particularly if it's someone who's famous. So if Pecker were not basically trying to help Trump, this would be great copy. This would sell a lot of National Enquirers to have on the cover that in fact he had paid off a porn star while his wife was pregnant. And that he was doing so in order to, you know, keep it secret during the election. Like, that in a sort of pure capitalistic sense, like, that would have been one of the biggest stories of all time for the National Enquirer. But instead, he, you know, killed that story to help his friend, help his friend's political campaign. And the other part of that, like you said, is like taking some sort of nugget, some sort of rumor, and then expanding on it. The word that Pecker used that really struck me was, yeah, we would take this, you know, tip or whatever, and we would, quote, embellish it, which is a, you know, really gentle way of saying lie.
Right.
You know, basically, like, we embellish the truth, which means you lied. And then meanwhile, you know, while Trump has played this game with the National Enquirer and was, you know, playing it extensively in that period, meanwhile, this is the guy who, you know, claimed that he wants to change the First Amendment's libel rules, in order to be able to punish newspapers that print the truth about him, actually.
And called everyone else out for fake news. No, he was fake news. I pulled, you know, yesterday happened to be the fourth anniversary of Donald Trump suggesting that we inject bleach or put UV lights in somehow in our bodies to kill off the COVID vaccine. And I pulled so I'm not going to play that because we've all heard it. But immediately a follow up from Phil Rucker of the Washington Post, listen to how Trump responded to him.
Tuning into these briefings, they want to get information and guidance and want to know what to do. They're not looking for rumors.
I'm the president and you're fake news. And you know what I'll say to you? I'll say very nicely, I know you well.
Okay, we don't even need to hear anymore. I'm the president and you're fake news. No, he was fake news. He was making shit up and giving it to his friend, the owner of the National Enquirer, who was putting it in massive font headlines to smear anybody who was a threat politically to Donald Trump.
Yeah, you know, again, in my personal capacity, I'm torn about like whether we should be, you know, whether some people should be calling Trump, you know, fake news, you know, Donald fake news Trump, fake news president, like, you know, kind of trying to stick that to his name, you know, or whether people are calling him Sleepy Don, you know, after this whole, you know, falling asleep in trial, where he, you know, again, on the projection has tried to project that onto, you know, Joe Biden, who, you know, could outpace, out bicycle Trump any day of the week. Maybe not outrace him in a golf cart, because that's you know, an even match, I guess, right, theoretically. But like in terms of actual physical capacity, yes, you've got, you know, someone who's pretty fit and someone who is not, you know, falling asleep at court. But back to this,
and farting apparently.
Back to that question of the fake news, like it is, I mean, it is just astonishing how much mileage he has gotten from those fake news claims, yes, when in fact evidence after evidence, like fact after fact after fact, reveals how much he lies. I forget what the total was after the Washington Post ended, you know, the full 4 years. Was it 30,000 lies?
I think it was over 30,000 lies.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet, you know, he had no hesitation to call the Washington Post fake news or to right, attack it at a moment, as you point out, at a moment in which he was literally
telling us to inject belief.
I would say like the layperson's phrase would be making shit up.
Yes. Yes.
By just suggesting on the fly that we should just ingest bleach or, yeah, you know, somehow put UV lights within our bodies by some miracle. And that would just save us. As people were beginning to die, you know, this was April in 2020, as you point out, when we had seen what had happened in Italy and other countries with mass graves because the COVID was spreading so fast, yep, and with no capacity to really mitigate it. And you know, the U.S. had yet to reach, you know, even like a 6-figure death was just at the beginning.
Yes.
But they knew, you know, he knew. We could all see with our own eyes what was happening around the world,
right,
with this really scary disease. And you had this, you know, again, all this in my personal capacity, this buffoon, this clown, as president up there, you know, in the White House, you know, claiming, you know, we can just, you know, bleach ourselves and somehow, can we do that?
Right. Yeah. In fact,
can we do that?
You know, like, Joe Biden outrageous. Yesterday noted the anniversary and actually had something to say about it.
By the way, remember when he was trying to deal with COVID, he said, just inject a little bleach in your veins. He missed it. All went to his hair.
Well, you know, I mean, the other part I remember quite well was this. So it was April when, in essence, he had to recognize in some form that this was an actual real emergency after his efforts to downplay it. But then I think by the end of this month or something, this month, that year, he was basically saying, you know, by next month, we'll have the churches open.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we'll have
Easter.
These mass meetings again. Easter.
Yes. Yeah. Well, it'll all magically, with spring, it'll just magically go away. He knew nothing. He was a fucking moron, still is. But, you know, this was a prime example. One of the other things that I remember is a reporter from NBC, Peter Alexander, I think, said, threw him a softball question. He's like, so what do you say to Americans who are scared? And he says, I tell them you're a horrible example of a newsman. What are you? Like, it's just everything about this man, but it just goes to his demeanor in the courtroom where yesterday the judge before the testimony started up again, before David Pecker's second turn on the stand, they did a hearing about his refusal to comply with the gag order. And Donald Trump just cannot comport himself like a responsible adult because he isn't one. And then the defense attorney started making excuses for him. And that's when the judge said, you're losing all credibility with this court, which apparently, I guess, at the beginning of a trial is not a good thing to hear from the judge.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure entirely what compels people to continue to become the attorneys of an unmanageable client who refuses to follow ordinary common sense advice about litigation. But apparently there's a market for it. And some people, like his previous lawyer in one of the previous cases, Elena Alina Habab, you know, get very famous for doing it. But I can't imagine that at the end of the day, it's actually worth it to like basically risk your reputation for someone who, you know, probably won't remember your name
right
next year.
Right. You know, the judge still hasn't ruled on the gag, any consequences for him. He could be fined $1,000 or up to 30 days in jail. What do you think, Lisa Graves? What should happen to him for his behavior?
Well, I think that they are going to have to start fining him, even though Trump is using each of these trials as major fundraising tools with his, you know, fan base. It is this sort of bizarre scenario that we live in now, where someone can be charged with more than 90 counts of crimes, backed up with real actual evidence that's pretty compelling on the face of it, and yet have, you know, millions of followers who believe him when he claims they're coming after you by coming right after me, which is just, you know, quite absurd. But it is a tactic of, you know, it is a tactic of someone who, you know, wants to lead a cult and wants people to believe that it's about them, when in fact it is about him. It's about his crimes, his activities that have been, you know, documented in these complaints and that, you know, hopefully will be proved at trial. But, you know, he thinks of this as a big money making machine for him. And so he's continuing to provoke, I think, trying to provoke the judge in order to get, you know, to get a consequence that then he can fundraise off of. It's so perverse. But I also hope that the judge will hold the lawyers accountable, because that also can happen if you have a client and you are not actually ensuring that that client follows the rules of the court. But we'll see. You know, we'll see what happens. But, you know, I am glad that the trial has begun. I'm sort of concerned that this jury has not been sequestered.
I know, me too.
I'm worried that there could be an array of intimidation tactics deployed against
even
one
of those
jurors.
We've already seen it. It already happened. Yeah. With the one saying, I can't do it, people know it's me. That because they what the idiot on Fox did, and then Trump retooting or truthing or whatever he does over there, and then embellishing it, and Jesse Waters then picking up on what Trump suggested on his not truth social. I mean, the whole thing is just, and if it was anybody else, they'd be behind bars by now, wouldn't they?
Well, you definitely risk lawyers and clients risk going to jail if they willfully violate orders of the court. That's, you know, classic contempt. And so I do think, like in many instances, if the person at the bar were not Trump, they would already have been fined. They already would have been, you know, the case is probably already would have been resolved by now.
Yeah.
Tried to completion.
Yes.
But, you know, there is this second tier of justice that seems to apply to Trump. But I'm hoping ultimately that he's held accountable. It's, again, my personal hope that he's held accountable under our law, because America is supposed to be a place where no one is above the law. And that includes Donald Trump. Doesn't include only him. It includes everyone.
Yeah. Tell me about it. Well, the testimony with David Pecker, appropriately named David Pecker, picks up again tomorrow morning. Here's my observation of him, seeing him going in and coming out of court and just hearing the reports from the people who are inside. I don't think he's well. And I can't see him surviving 4 or 5 more weeks of this. So, you know, it's going to be an everyday thing we watch. But I think there's going to be some kind of medical emergency where Trump is taken out of the courtroom. That's my prediction. If I had to look in a crystal ball and say, what do you think will happen? That would be my answer. I somehow don't see this ending.
Yeah, I don't know. I live in the moment. I have to confess, I am in the midst of what is happening today,
and, which is where we all should be. Forget my speculation. It's just when my mind goes places. So
yeah, no, but it's always wonderful to hear from you and to be part of your show, Nicole.
Oh, it's so great to have
you
here.
I really appreciate your personal friendship and the chance to share my personal views on your program and have these really interesting conversations, which I deeply appreciate.
Oh, and so do I. Now, I'm happy for you. Are you going on vacation? You're going to be gone most of next month, yeah?
Well, we're working on that. We'll see. We'll see if that actually happens, given all the cases that are in play. So,
well, you have an open invitation. I would be honored to have you here as much or as often as you want to come on and talk about what's happening. Because, frankly, you're just brilliant, Lisa. I love you. The chat room loves you. I always get tons of emails when you're on the show. It's an honor to have you here, and I would love your input as much or as often as you want to give it, and you can. So we'll keep in touch, and you let me know when you can do it, and the door's open for you at
any
time.
I appreciate that. I'll be coming for a three-day weekend sometimes.
Please. Well, I've got room for you here. Come visit. It's already hot. We had our first 100-degree day already.
Ooh, that's hot. We don't have flowers yet.
The pool. Oh, well, the flowers are amazing. The pool is already 80 degrees.
Oh, well, see, now you're just making my wish for a vacation grow and to come visit you there in your new home state.
So come to Arizona. You can stay here. We'll put you up. Jackson would love to see you. He may even jump in the pool with you.
Well, that would be fine with me. That would be fine.
All right. We'll talk. Lisa Graves, thank you so much. Read TrueNorthResearch.org. Understand that when she comes on this show, she comes on in her own personal capacity. But check out the work that they're doing over at True North Research, because it is imperative and it's important and it's great. And Lisa, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on. All right.
Talk to you soon. Bye.
Bye.
Lisa Graves, she is the best. With that, we're done for today. Tomorrow's Thursday. Howie Klein will be here. We have to talk about the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Cher? Cool in the Gang? They need to change the name of it to the Popular Music Hall of Fame. But we'll have that discussion with Howie Klein and politics tomorrow. And then, of course, Marcy Wheeler will help us end the week on Friday. And oh boy, what a week it's going to be. To be continued tomorrow. Peace out.